I'm Jimmy Apple, the EMS Avenger. This is EMS Avenger 20 Minutes to Save the World. I'm with the founder and a educator with Flybridge Ed. You should almost certainly be familiar with Eric Bauer, who also has, over the last year, pulled in some serious brass with some awards on his educating prowess, something that I think is very well deserved. And today, as far as saving the world goes, I'm not sure we have to, because, Eric, you've already talked to us about resuscitating before you intubate. And you've taught everyone about the proper intubation practices. And so our providers, they've resuscitated before they've intubated. They've engaged in all these practices. They've dropped that plastic. So that's the finish line. We're done, right? We saved the patient.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you having me on the podcast, man. And I've loved watching you grow and what you're doing out there. So very proud of you.
Appreciate it.
This topic is very timely. You know, we have seen, and I think you said it perfectly, a big push the last 5 to 8 years on peri-intubation resuscitation, and that it's not just about, as you said, dropping the plastic through the V. It is much more than that. And, you know, we were defined by success, you know, and I think that's a really important piece that we'll talk about. But what is first pass success and what is an attempt? And as we have both probably grown in our professions, we've changed our mindset on what a true attempt is. And I think we've done a really good job in the peri-intubation phase. But one area that we're lacking is in that post-intubation phase. And that's where, again, I feel like this is a very timely talk.
So we actually have to manage that patient after we intubate them. Like, we still have to continue to treat.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think you know, we were talking pre-show. What is a saying that maybe encompasses? And there's a lot of them. And I think you had a great one. The one I often use in this course or this lecture or this topic is by Napoleon: "The most dangerous moment comes with victory." And I think that really sums up. You know, we've got the intubation, we've secured it, we've even confirmed it with end-tidal CO2 waveform capnography. But there's a lot of things that happen after that intubation has been secured that can really alter the path of the patient. And so really, that's where I came up with this acronym. I know you and I have talked about, you know, acronyms. Are they good? Are they bad? I've never been an acronym type of guy. I mean, I think there's acronyms that I've learned as an EMT that I still remember, but I'm not one that needs an acronym to memorize something. But I definitely, it led me down the road, kind of bringing all this together to an acronym, and that's what we're going to talk about today.
Well, I think there's room for an appropriately implemented acronym. I'll sometimes scroll social media and see different providers provide these acronyms to remember certain things. And, you know, some of these acronyms, you know, are literally just the alphabet. And I'm like, what am I supposed to do with that? That's cognitively, I can't absorb any of that. And so they just really become like a cognitive roadblock rather than an actual assist. But I think if you can have a succinct, well-stated acronym that you can get in front of someone time and time again, such as like the HEAVEN criteria, or what used to be LEMONS and is now the HEAVEN criteria, you know, advanced providers have seen that over and over and over and have managed to bank it. So with this acronym, which for those who don't know, Eric has been making the rounds with this acronym he's been working on for post-intubation management, FACTORS, spelled with a PH. And so we're going to go through FACTORS one letter at a time to help assist the provider in keeping an eye on their patient and managing that post-intubation state.
Yeah, no, perfectly said. You know, I have to give credit also to Dr. Mike Loria for, you know, he's our chief medical officer. He is a truly amazing guy and always willing to really help. And I think really where he comes into play is, you know, I had a lot of ideas. I was trying to put together this acronym. You know, and then just running it by somebody that has more objective knowledge, right, overall, and he really was helpful in bringing the little pieces maybe that I was missing together. And then I did have a meeting with Scott Weingard as well, and had him review this. And so I feel like this is well-reviewed. I definitely feel like we That doesn't mean we can't change this. So I think before we start, I really want comments. Anything we've missed, anything we could do better, right? I think collectively we're much smarter than any of us are individually. And so, you know, it's all perspective, and I'd love to continue to make this better than it is. You know, we are going to follow this up. Lori and I are going to write a paper on it and publish that. And so, you know, there's some big things to come, but I just want to make sure it's perfect.
That's awesome. Well, let's jump right into it. So we have a patient that we need to intubate, and we have resuscitated them prior to intubation. We've given IV fluids. We've maybe administered a pressor or a push-dose pressor. We have provided them flush rate oxygen, maybe even BiPAP to get that PaO2 reserve up. We've put them in the proper position. We've ramped them up. We've got that airway vector exactly the way it's supposed to be. We've used a bougie, and we have confirmed with NTidal, and we are perfect. We are getting chest rise. We've got good waveform. So let's start with the P in factors. Where are we going with this?
Yeah, and I know we have limited time. I just want to start off by saying why do we call this factors impacting the Platinum 10? And I think it's important for the industry, if you're not in a part of the industry that measures first pass success based on -1A, I think we need to define that real fast.
Okay.
That's first pass success without desaturation or hypotension. And so basically -1A says that what is the blood pressure right before intubation? That systolic has to be above 90, SpO2 has to be above 90. If it is not, and you intubate successfully, that is still a failed attempt. So an attempt from a success standpoint is not whether you pass the ET tube through the cords. It's based on resuscitation endpoints.
Sure, it's what trajectory you're putting the patient on, right?
Right.
Because we know that patients who are intubated who are either hypotensive or hypoxic, there's a significant association with increased mortality under those conditions.
Right. So most programs have a guideline that says, hey, we're going to resuscitate to a systolic of 100, gives you a little bit of a leeway, and an SpO2 greater than 94%. So those are the two metrics that we try to hit. And then we pull the trigger on intubation, and then we get to the 10-minute phase after intubation. And that 10-minute phase after intubation, the same thing. Up to 10 minutes after, if your systolic drops below 90 or SpO2 drops below 90, that's a really difficult thing. You can get to 9-minute mark, and that blood pressure cycles, and you're now hypotensive. That's a failed attempt. So it really, I think, brings the level up across the board, where we really have to make sure we're crossing our T's and dotting our I's. And that leads us into the first part of factors, and that is P for positive pressure. And, you know, I think out of all of the areas of this acronym we're going to talk about, I think this is the biggest part. The more and more I study this, the more and more I read on this, this is definitely an area that I don't know how we can fix this. I know little ways maybe we can make it better, but when we think about positive pressure ventilation, got to start back at normal physiology. We're breathing based on negative pressure breathing. Our chest wall expands, our diaphragm flattens down, and by that negative pressure breathing, we actually pull blood into the right atrium and right ventricle. It optimizes preload when we breathe based on negative pressure. Well, when we flip a patient to positive pressure ventilation, automatically you are reducing preload, which causes now a reduction of preload into the left atrium, and ultimately a reduction in cardiac output.
I'm going to interrupt you for a sec. That's so important. That is so important. And I just want to emphasize to people who heard you say positive pressure and were like, well, yeah, derp. I mean, of course. But no, you have to be thinking about not just the fact that you're providing positive pressure, but you are affecting the patient's overall physiology, and not necessarily in a good way with that positive pressure.
Yeah, and that's where it's real difficult, because when you look at the equipment we use, we obviously have to transition from passive oxygenation, as you laid out, cannula, flush rate, non-rebreather, maybe BiPAP or CPAP, to now a BVM with a PEEP valve. And I think when you look at a BVM and how it's managed and how it's utilized, I think it's mismanaged. we mismanage it. I don't care how good we are, unless you really are actively training on that piece of equipment, we bag too hard, we bag too fast, we're bagging with massive volumes that exceed 1,000 mils. And, you know, if you exceed, you know, talking to Loria, there's studies out there that are now showing that even if you increase the pressure in when you do your inspiratory maneuver to greater than 15 centimeters of water, that are actually a study showing that in some patients that will open the gastric sphincter and allow volume into the stomach, right? As low as 15, which the BVMs always are, you know, going into the red at 20. And that's mm-hmm. always the number we've always taught. So I think it's just really, really important to understand that training, that piece of BLS equipment is probably less likely to be a focal point in training, but it is one of the biggest problems in transitioning somebody to positive pressure because of the huge volumes and how fast we bag and how you're not allowing for exhalation and how hard you're squeezing the BVM. And let's be honest, a lot of times if we are really busy, we're going to hand the BVM to somebody that maybe is a lower level provider. They're part of the team. They're essential parts of the team, but they might not have the same level of experience. So we have to watch that very carefully and manage and really coach them and explain to them, hey, I want you to bag every eight seconds, or I want you to follow this light or the blink or, you know, something. But I think that there's a bigger piece to this, and this is where, you know, we got two types of patients, right? We have a patient maybe in a hospital setting where we're going from bedside to bedside. We intubate in the hospital. We're pretty quick to transition to mechanical ventilation. That is the key, because mechanical ventilation, we control the pressures. We use lung protective tidal volumes, you know, and I say that from 6 to 8 mils per kilo, right? And use... you know, use a machine that is gonna deliver the breath consistently every time. We're watching the parameters, and it's much better than BVM ventilation. That scene flight or that patient on the scene of the side of the road, that's where it's not happening. And those are our sickest patients a lot of times, where we're even in the aircraft sense, they're bagging from the ambulance to the aircraft. And so I'm starting to really think, and this was an area I talked to both the physicians that I named earlier, is there evidence to support going ventilator to the ambulance on a scene flight? That's going to be a controversial thing just because that's a second piece of equipment or third piece of equipment we have to deal with heading back to the aircraft. You know, I don't know if that's what the right answer is, but ultimately we know that the BVM is a big problem. We got to transition away from the BVM. And, you know, we were talking about, you know, pediatric neonatal resuscitation before the show. And a great example of that is a diaphragmatic hernia. One of the things you never do in a diaphragmatic hernia for these little neonates is ever use a BVM, right? You never bag them just because of how bad that is.
Right, right.
You know, so you have to obviously ventilate the patient. But it's how can you do that in a managed, systematic way that's going to control pressures, control inspiratory pressures, control rate? All that makes a huge difference.
Well, you just answered your own question with a ventilator.
Right.
Just you know, you
people convinced.
Yeah. I mean, and I want to go back to something you said, and it's okay if this runs on a little bit. You mentioned that we often hand that bag off to somebody who may not be the most well-trained person on a scene. And I think that's really significant because it's true. And we see that often in cardiac arrest, where often an EMR or, you know, an EMT, someone who's new, is just given that skill because on the outward appearance, it seems easy and intuitive. Squeeze the bag, get air in. But in reality, it comes with one of the highest skill thresholds in almost anything we do during a resuscitation. And there really is a disparity. We've created an incredibly detailed skill set when it comes to intubating that just hits oven mitts when it comes to managing the ventilation as soon as you pass the tube. There really does need to be an emphasis on services finding a way to perfect post-intubation ventilation prior to them ever getting on a ventilator. And that may mean let's get them on a ventilator as quick as possible.
No, you're spot on. You know, one of the obviously the barrier to entry for many programs EMS wise is finances, is budget, right? And so obviously air medical, everybody has a ventilator, critical care transport, everybody has a ventilator. But, you know, if we're using this concept across all spectrums, there's going to be a problem there, right? So we just, you know, also have to go back to retraining how to use a BVM correctly.
Absolutely. And if you can't afford a ventilator, certainly you can afford a manometer, right?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So we are applying positive pressure and we are thinking about the effects of our positive pressure. And we're going to move on in our factors acronym to H, or our factors mnemonic to H. What are we doing here?
Yeah. So H is hypoxia. You know, when you think about hypoxia, obviously there's multiple areas to kind of focus on. And again, I just want to emphasize what we're really saying with factors is these are proactive pieces of the puzzle that you need to be aware of after intubation, right? These are all areas that could cause decompensation. So that's what we're doing, is we're being proactive, not reactive. We're looking at these things and ensuring if we see it, we can fix it or try to prevent it from happening. So the first one is derecruitment. Derecruitment is something that is super simple. And this is, again, this is a lack of education. And I blame myself. I mean, I've been saying this for quite a long time, but it's still, you know, you don't realize it. And here's the problem. We're really good at talking about clamping the ET tube if we're using PEEPs of 8 to 10 or greater, ventilator to ventilator. But we do not do a good job teaching if you're using a BVM with a PEEP valve with greater than 5 of PEEP and you go to transition to your ventilator, nobody's clamping the ET tube. And you just lost all the recruitment.
Right. And so sometimes that bag even will pop off while you're bagging.
Sure.
Yeah.
So that's something just to be aware of, right? And, you know, the adult BVM to ventilator. Well, why would that cause hypoxia? I've seen this lots of times. I've seen this in chart reviews. I've been called about this. I've been emailed about this. And here's why. You give big, huge breaths with a BVM that maybe you're getting 12 to 1500 mil breath and you're getting this good recruitment because remember, inspiratory phases, that's what recruits the lung. And then you transition to your ventilator and you're now using even 8 mL/kg, 6 to 8 mL/kg of tidal volume for a 70 kilo average male. The average male is 70 kilos ideal body weight, right? 5'10", 5'11". And that is a 420 to 560 mil tidal volume. That's a third of what you were just given. So you've lost recruitment just based on the reduction in volume that you're giving. So in some cases, what I say is you got to look at the patient. There are we'll just use male patients. There are some big guys out there, right, that have big barrel chests that are taller, that are just bigger stature. They might not handle a 6 to 8 mL/kg tidal volume. They might need a 10 mL/kg tidal volume just based on the weight of the chest. And then I think this is the other problem is that we aren't proactive enough to sit our patients up. And you hit on this in the very beginning. We're sitting our patients up in the intubation process. But are we maintaining that position in that semi-Fowler's position at 30 degrees? And that is one of the easiest ways to re-recruit lung is to sit a patient up, right? We lose 50% of our lung recruitment when we lay a patient down. So you couple those two things, you could easily, just based on those two small little areas, have a big drop in SpO2, a big drop in chest rise. And, you know, what I always try to say is what the ventilator is going to be much better at delivering volume than a BVM.
So
translate it back to your BVM and try to figure out what was your BVM doing, because that's what will happen. And I'll let you kind of jump in. I don't want to interrupt you, but they'll put them back on the BVM and then they'll bag them up and this SpO2s come back up. Well, we'll translate what you were doing back to the ventilator. And, you know, maybe that's your bagging real slow. So those are more prolonged inspiratory phases. Again, were you giving massive breaths? What do you think?
And not thinking about that, not being proactive about thinking about how your patient could become hypoxic, creates a situation where you may transfer a patient from a BVM to the ventilator and see that decline that you were talking about. We've all seen this. We've all seen when we've taken a patient off the BVM initially to the ventilator where we just couldn't reproduce what we were doing on that BVM. And so what do? We go back to the BVM because that was working. However, now we're having multiple transfers of different devices that it may be costing the patient de-recruitment. So in the process of going back to what is working, we may just be stacking problems on top of each other that ultimately neither the vent or the BVM is going to fix because you're going to lose your patient. So being proactive about that anticipated hypoxia is what we're really focusing on.
Yeah, no, you're perfectly said. And the last thing is just, why were you there? Why were you called there, right? What's the pathophysiology? What's the lung physiology? Normal, what's their chronic state, and what's their, if they have a chronic lung disease, or is this an acute thing, and what is the problem? And that's where, we often teach to kind of think about the three big gas laws when it comes to, what we call a venous admixture, meaning that these patients have true, minute ventilation is not really the problem. It's more about diffusion across the alveolar capillary level, right? So what are the three? Well, number one, Dalton's law. We increase the partial pressure by adding FiO2. That's simple. Turn up the FiO2. Number two, Fick's law, add peep. Well, we've already done that. That adds surface area. And number three, Henry's law is basically add pressure above the gas over the solution. You're just basically adding whatever that device is. If it's a BVM, if it's a, you can simply do that with hyponasal cannula, right? It doesn't have to be mechanical ventilation per se. But trying to just drive that O2 molecule down into the solution and just understand that that's the other thing, and I don't want to get into the weeds. I think the more and more I learn and the more I surround myself with maybe physicians that can share their experiences in the ICU, talking to Loria, it's very common and very normal and very accepted to have SpO2s of 86 to 88%. Right. When you start thinking about how the affinity for oxygen binding with hemoglobin and what that truly means, and truly what does the ABG say? What does the PaO2 say? What does the SaO2 say? Those are the bigger two numbers. Obviously, you can't look at that stuff in the field as easy unless you have point of care testing. But, just being more accepting, I'm not saying to accept an 88% SpO2, but sometimes, the SpO2 is not going to just rocket back up, right? We got to be okay with slow incremental increases, and that's going to be based on how long you have with your patient.
Sure. They didn't get to where they were overnight unless it was some sort of trauma or something like that, and we're not going to fix them in 5 minutes.
Correct.
So we've been proactive about our hypoxia, and we've corrected any hypoxia that we've seen, and so we're moving on to the A in factors. Where are we now?
Yeah, so A is acidosis, and I'll just kind of keep this short and sweet. Acidemia, the biggest thing here with acidemia that I just want us to be aware of is, what is the peri-intubation respiratory rate prior to intubation? That's always going to be a clue, and there's two clues there is always consider it hypoxia. Your patient's always going to be tachypneic if they're hypoxia. That's the body's way of trying to generate minute ventilation to improve. And number two, consider it in a partially compensated state, meaning they are in a respiratory alkalosis in an attempt to keep that pH higher than what it would normally be without the compensation. And so, the key is understanding the disease processes. I definitely have podcasts on this. I have education on this, but Goldmark is a great acronym to use. And really the three that I would always focus on is anybody with ethylene glycol poisoning. We'll say four, anybody with methanol or ethanol poisoning, anybody with aspirin overdose or ketoacidosis. Those are the ones that will definitely put your patient in a partially compensated state, meaning they're going to be tachypneic and you have to match their minute ventilation or you're going to have major issues.
Sure. And we don't want to attack acidosis simply by giving them a slug of bicarb. We want to manage their respiratory state and manage the underlying condition to correct that.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up. That is something that you often hear. It seems like an easy fix, but all you're doing is giving a big huge jam of acid.
Yeah, it's basically just a timed grenade that you're putting down the tube or putting in their veins. Okay, so we're managing acidosis, and we're moving on to the C in factors. And what do we have to look for? What do we have to take care of with C?
Yeah, so for C, it's just a kind of a reminder about cardiac output. And, you know, we already talked about cardiac output and the reduction of preload with our positive pressure. But here's where we get into really looking at the heart rate and the stroke volume and making sure that you don't need to intervene in some area, right? Heart rate's easy. It's either too fast or it's too slow, or it's just right. You know, and the too fast, what I always point out is, remember, tachycardia is defined as anything over 100. That means that if you had a rate of 170 narrow complex, that does not mean that's SVT.
Right.
That means that is sinus tach, and you use the equation of 220 minus your age. Right. And I think the important thing is to rule out the four H's. So four H's that cause tachycardias in those higher numbers. And those four H's are these: hypoxia, hypovolemia, hyperthermia, and hypotension. Right. So all of those will cause a tachycardia. And I think the one that's often missed is the hyperthermia fever. Right. Somebody that has a fever. And so what I always say is, don't just jump down the ACLS algorithm and jump into ACLS and try to give adenosine or calcium channel blocker or cardiovert somebody. Make sure you rule out those four things before you jump down that algorithm. Stroke volume is, you know, a little bit more complex. And I say that, you know, stroke volume, we all learn stroke volume is EMTs. But in critical care, stroke volume is something that we are able to affect with different medications. And I think even on the ground EMS side, depending on where you're working in the United States, you might have protocols or guidelines that allow you. So just remember, stroke volume is about preload, understanding what is our preload state, understanding what is afterload, right? Afterload is the big one that can really hinder cardiac output. And really, those are those cardiomyopathies, the chronic states, and understanding, hey, maybe giving a medication like dobutamine or milrinone or even nitro, right? Nitro is not going to have any inotropic assistance, but sometimes by vasodilating that afterload side, it allows the myocardium to contract against a lower upward pressure, which improves cardiac output, right? And so it's just a really quick reminder of, hey, look at volume in, volume out, make sure that you're good there. Identify, hey, do I have a patient that has a cardiomyopathy that's chronic that is inhibiting their cardiac output? You may not be able to do anything for that, right? Depending on where you're at, what protocols you have, what guidelines you have. But again, what I always try to say, and I think you and I agree on this, critical care medicine isn't always about having cool procedures or medications. For me, critical care medicine is having a much broader understanding of medicine to where I can make decisions at a higher level and sometimes make decisions to not do something.
Sure. I think critical care is a process. Yes. Of doing everything you can to avoid getting to the point where you're using those rescue medications or rescue procedures or critical procedures. I wanted to come back real quick because you were talking about the heart rate being too fast or too slow or just right. What I wanted to clarify for the provider who's listening, that just right doesn't happen in a vacuum. You have a patient with a heart rate of 80, but a blood pressure of 60 over 40. Then that heart rate's not just right, and you need to look into why that patient isn't compensating with that heart rate.
Yeah, that was a good point. Yeah, absolutely. Right? Are they prescribed a beta blocker and they're not compensating, or you know, is that like almost irreversible shock? Right.
Right.
So no, great point.
Yeah. So we've spent some time on the patient's hemodynamics, kind of check the plumbing, turn some knobs, push some buttons, and we want to move on now from the C to the T in factors. And so tell us what we're going to be focusing on here.
Yeah, and just to end on the cardiac output, I think it segues really well to the transfer. Is a lot of these blend together, is cardiac output's also evaluating, do I need to redose my push-dose pressor, right? Whether that's epi, whether that's phenylephrine, whether that's vasopressin, whatever you're using, maybe you have multiple, maybe you have either one, right? So I would go epi if I had somebody that I think needs inotropic help. I might go phenylephrine if I have a heart rate of 150. I don't want to add more heart rate. I just want some squeeze. So
right.
Clinical reasoning based on those two options. But that progresses or transitions us to the transfer side. And this is just a reminder of, man, you're going from an ambulance, or let's say the side of the road to the ambulance. Maybe you're out in the field. You got to walk all this way. Who's managing the patient? I mean, we're trying to, but there's a lot of stuff that can happen, right? Especially if it's just you and your partner, and you might have one person helping, right? There's limited resource areas. What about going from an ambulance to the helicopter? What are we worried about?
Right.
Like if we're loading hot, you're worried about who's coming to the aircraft with you. You're worried about stuff flying into the rotor system. You're working about not having somebody walk into the tail rotor. You know, I mean, when I'm going to the aircraft, I'm thinking about safety. I'm not thinking about the patient. Like, hopefully I've got the patient packaged. I've got them sedated. I've got push dose pressor already given, right? That is a period that a lot of stuff can go wrong because we're focused on situational awareness, our safety, the safety of our crew, safety of the bystanders, safety of everybody. Ambulance to the hospital, hospital back to the ambulance, right? Any of those transition phases, that's where things go wrong. I mean, just think about how many patients you've had where you move them and halfway to the ambulance, you're doing a transfer and they arrest on you, right? And
right.
So you just have to be ahead, again, be proactive. I don't know if there's a lot that you can do other than make sure that they have good IV access, that you have access to the IVs, that you've given push dose pressors, that you have, you know, you've given them good sedation, pain management. It's kind of a last little check before you move towards your whatever your destination is.
Well, that's when another mnemonic or acronym comes into play, which is the 5 P's, which is proper planning prevents poor performance. When you know you're going to be getting that patient out of a house or out of a ditch, and you're going to be pushing that patient across some grass or up a hill or down a driveway, hopefully you've got a push dose pressor in your pocket, right? We don't want something to happen to that patient and us not being able now to take care of that while we're moving, because we're not going to sit there in the middle of somebody's lawn when we can throw a rock at our transport unit. We're pulling up push dose pressors and that sort of thing. But at the same time, we do want to be able to take care of it right away. So we've considered the transport aspect of factors. And so now we're moving on to the O. And so bring us through the O part of factors.
Yeah, and again, a lot of these blend together. So O is going to be ongoing pharmacology. And that is where, again, are we using, you know, I think the area that I really always kind of emphasize is, have we used for our career succinylcholine, and now we're primarily using rocuronium? And I know for me, succinylcholine, I knew, had a half-life of about 5 minutes. I knew inevitably if we got to the aircraft, my patient's going to be waking up, they're going to be reaching for the ET tube. And so we were really proactive in giving sedation prior to leaving the ambulance, right? And I'm talking about from my air medical time. And I think it's the same thing. You leave a house, you've RSI'd inside of a house, you're going to the ambulance, you're having to weed your way through a house, you're going down the steps of a deck, right? You don't want them reaching up and yanking the ET tube out at that time. So you're very proactive in doing that. Rocuronium, though, I think there's a piece of that because we're so used to looking at our patient and watching movement and watching changes. Now we have a patient paralyzed for 20, 30 minutes. And so it's definitely an area that I know I have missed. I'll admit that I have gotten in the aircraft and gotten 10 minutes into a flight and realized we have not given post-intubation sedation. Now, luckily, we gave ketamine as our induction agent, and that has a longer half-life. But, you know, it's kind of one of those, oh, my gosh. So one of the areas that I tried to change in that piece of our management was, what would be something I could do? And mine was, when I got in the aircraft and I buckled my seatbelt, we lifted and started for level flight. I was pulling my syringe out. I was getting the medications out, and we were reevaluating sedation pain management at that time. It could be earlier, as I said, during the transfer. Maybe it's better to do that when you are about to leave wherever you intubate the patient. But this needs to be an ongoing piece. And, you know, when I do chart reviews for a few of the programs that I consult, where I'm seeing this is I'm seeing fentanyl primarily being mismanaged. Fentanyl has a half-life, guys, of 3 to 7 minutes, not 15. So fentanyl needs to be given every 5. 5 is a nice round number. Your ketamine can be given every 10 to 15, but you know you need to be dosing fentanyl more often. Smaller aliquots more often is much more cardioprotective. And so I think it's an ongoing thing. Then do you say, hey, now we're going to start a drip. We're going to do a fentanyl drip. We're going to do a ketamine drip. And all that is going to be relative to your transport time, I get. But these are just considerations, again, that you know, this seems like a lot, but if you start doing this and employing this on every one of your innovations, it will become second nature.
Well, I think it's a checklist this. Like anything else. Like you should have, you know, I know that Air Methods, they live and die by the heaven criteria, yes. You know, with that checklist. You should have your heaven criteria out. You should have your factors checklist out, right? Yes. Circling back to talking about sucks and rock, you mentioned something that's probably a real problem, which is that your patient used to be able to tell you exactly when they needed their next sedative dose and pain management dose. And it happened relatively quickly, like you said, 5 to 7 minutes. But now with ROC, they don't tell you, and you have to anticipate it. And I really wonder how many providers are actually thinking about the clock when they give ROC and when that next sedation dose and that pain management dose is due.
No, you're right. Yeah, and you know, there's so many, maybe we do a follow-up podcast, there's so much about the whole ROC versus sucks thing that I think we miss, that is...
Challenge accepted.
...peri-innovation phase and success rates as well. So, I mean, that's a whole other topic.
Yep. All right, so we have managed this patient's pain, we've managed their sedation, we're keeping an eye on them to make sure that they're comfortable and that they're not trying to breathe along with the ventilator. Maybe even providing a second paralytic like Vecuronium if you have a longer transport time. And so we're moving on past the O and getting into the R. So get us into the R.
Well, and I think you said it perfect. We've done a good job in the very beginning of the resuscitation phase in the peri-innovation phase. But that has to be ongoing. We can't stop once we have victory, as we said. And so, again, have we evaluated shock index in the peri-intubation phase? Do we have a shock index greater than or equal to 0.9? That tells us, hey, we have a patient that's likely going to decline, that's likely going to do poor. We readjust or adjust our ketamine dosing to that. And I think the key with that is less is better. You know, one program I work with, Polymedflat, we just changed our guideline to be across the board, 1 mg/kg is the maximum RSI dose. That's maximum. 0.5 mg/kg is a high shock index dose. Because we're seeing even with high shock index, lowering it from 2 mg/kg to 1 mg/kg, we're still having post-intubation hypotension. Now, is it the positive pressure that we talked about? Is it ketamine? I don't know what it is, right? It definitely needs to be studied, but we're trying to identify if it is truly the ketamine. So we'll see. It's being tracked ongoing with CQI data, every chart's being evaluated. But you know, the shock index is going to tell you, hey, we got to continue to make sure the tank is filled. We got to continue with blood product administration if we know we have the indications and you have blood products available. You know, did you start that in the peri-intubation phase? And you need to continue that. And obviously use the surrogates that we all learn of. You know, we're still focusing on that systolic of 90 as the bottom baseline. But remember, that systolic of 90 is really important for traumatic brain injury patients because that is the target that we focus on. Obviously, in a permissive hypotension sense, without TBI, we can go down to 60, but not during that 10-minute phase after. Again, that is something that I need to talk to the author or the original physician that came up with -1A, Bill Pinkley out of UNC AirCare. How do you treat that, right? You have a permissive hypotension patient that needs to be permissively hypotensive based on penetrating trauma. Well, that doesn't fit into -1A.
Right.
So I don't know how to deal with that. I don't know what the answer is there. Something that I just thought about a few weeks ago. The point for resuscitation is resuscitation needs to continue and be ongoing. And again, is this another opportunity to evaluate, hey, do I need to give another dose of push-dose stressor?
Yeah, and emphasis on the ongoing process. Always be resuscitating. And even with every single aspect so far that we've gone through with factors, these are all ongoing things. It is not a point-by-point checklist, but a prompt for you to consider all of these things all of the time during your ongoing management of that patient. So that leads us to the last letter of this mnemonic, which is S. So drop the S on us, Eric.
Yeah, S is just suction, right? One of those BLS maneuvers we're all taught, but I think it's one of those things that we often forget, that we obviously often leave out. And I think you could also add to this, have you dropped an NG or OG tube? I think that is a must. Any intubated patient needs to have either of those placed. But just understanding that good suction is going to help prevent ventilator-associated pneumonia. You know, looking and making sure you have a cuff pressure, that you have a cuffalator or something, a mammometer on your cuff, that you're maintaining pressures of 25 to 30. You know, make sure that you're reducing the incidence of VAP, as I said, limiting those secretions, and understanding that, that suctioning out the ET tube is just one of those good, good, you know, nursing bundles, right? And that is, it's going to optimize oxygenation ventilation because you're going to have, you know, good minute ventilation without any gunk getting, you know, clogging the tube or not allowing for optimal flow, which will also increase peak inspiratory pressures and, you know, it causes a lot of turbulent flow. So there's a lot of ramifications to not suctioning. And then ultimately, does it lead to mucus plugging that causes, you know, these small little areas of our lungs to become atelectatic, where we have small areas that we have lung collapse, right? And not lung collapse. If you hear that, you know, that's something I've learned over the years. Lung collapse from a paramedic or EMT standpoint is usually what we associate as a pneumothorax. But in medicine in general, lung collapse is just atelectasis. It's just, you know, no recruitment based on maybe mucus plugging, or, you know, we'll see that in distal lung units that you're just not filling. So, you know, it's just good overall care.
And you cannot overstate the importance of the suctioning. It's something that may be a secondary consideration to many providers, but it is literally a reversal of extremis in some cases. And not just with the tube, but in any respiratory case. We responded earlier this week to a 10-week-old infant who had RSV, bronchiolitis, and we were prepared to put this kid on RAM. And I was like, let's just suction the airways first and see, you know, let's get everything clear first. Let's clear the plumbing up. And so we did some nasal suctioning with a olive tip, and we just neti potted that kid, and it made the administration of RAM completely unnecessary. Like, it completely changed the clinical course.
Yeah, that's huge, man. Nice job.
Well, we've gotten all the way through factors, and I think we've actually put some really good tools in the toolbox of providers who are out there innovating. And I want to mention that you actually offer this as a course. It's an adjunct on FlightBridge to the Art of Ventilation course, which is a really, really good course. I want to encourage anyone out there that if you're looking for a good ventilation course, you really can't do much better than the Art of Ventilation. And unfortunately, you missed EMS Week this year, if you're listening right now, where FlightBridge was giving that away. And they got that into the hands of thousands upon thousands of people. But this is available if you want to go through it on their website. And Eric has made multiple appearances at conferences and on social media to promote the factors mnemonic.
Yeah, no, it's part of our standard, you know, refresher content as well. So it's something that I think is important, you know. And just to summarize, remember, we're talking about positive pressure. We're talking about hypoxia, acidosis, cardiac output, transfer, ongoing pharmacology, resuscitation, remember, it's ongoing, and then suction. And I think you said it again perfectly. Heaven criteria is your peri-intubation resuscitation acronym, and this is going to be your post-intubation acronym to really focus on.
Yep. I liken this sort of approach to patient care. It's almost as if you see a patient drowning and your instinct is to go out and swim out to that patient so you can rescue them from drowning. That's the intubation. Factors is the you being prepared to actually get them back to shore safely, because some people will react and go out there and save a drowning patient, and they just aren't prepared to get a drowning patient back to safety. So factors could literally save your drowning patient who is intubated.
Absolutely.
Thanks for appearing on the podcast, Eric. Appreciate you, man.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
Catch you next one.